In a sleepy little West Texas town where not much happened all year, they were preparing for the event of the year, namely the high school play. And unfortunately, they had miscast the role of the young man who was to play that part, and it was an inviolate rule. Once you cast the part, you could not change it. At the critical point in the play, this boy was to go down on his knees and propose before this young lady. And he was to face a crisis when the window went up and the jilted suitor was to fire the gun through it. And this kid was supposed to leap to his feet and holler, "Good heavens, I'm shot." And that's just about the way he said it. And they drilled him and coached him, but the kid had no histrionic ability whatever. He just couldn't identify with the part. So finally the night of the play came, and as the high school coach was going out the front door, he noticed his son's air rifle in the vestibule. And he got an idea. You let me finish the story. So at the critical point, this kid goes down on his knees before this young thing. The window goes up. The gun is fired by the jilted suitor, and this high school coach is just standing off in the wings, and with split-second accuracy and timing, he just nicked the boy's trousers as the kid stole the show. Leaping to his feet, he shouted, "Good heavens, I am shot!" Now, I suspect that this probably expresses your sentiments at this juncture. You have got to be the most amazingly patient and responsive people I have ever had to speak to. I have seldom plagued myself upon an audience as excessively as I have this week. I sort of feel covered over with guilt. So tonight, we're coming to our fourth today. You heard of the professor who dreamed that he was teaching a class and woke up and found that he was. This could be my dilemma tonight. Now, the assigned subject for tonight is the Bible and sex. And this is an extremely ambitious subject. In fact, I feel like the little boy who chose to write his first term paper, 500 words, no more, and who chose as his subject the universe, its origin, nature, and destiny. So I want to assure you right at the outset that our approach will be highly selective, not exhaustive. We will talk about some things that the Bible has to say about sex. And I would like you to turn in our Father's Word to the book of Genesis. My primary purpose is not only to minister to you again, but also to give you some biblical ammunition with which to minister to your generation. I hope you are never ashamed to discuss what God was never ashamed to create. And our position concerning sex is going by default, because many of us are silent in 27 languages when we should be shouting from every platform what God's Word has to say about this subject. The first two chapters of Genesis comprise a very critical foundation, not only for the subject, but for the entire revelation which God has given. These are the creation accounts. And as you know well, on the basis of our study, chapter divisions are ignored. And this is another classic case in point, a very infelicitous chapter division. It should break between verses 3 and 4 of chapter 2. And beginning at chapter 2 and verse 4, and going to the end of that chapter, verse 25, you have the second section of the creation accounts. The first section focuses upon the creation of the universe and the prevailing name of God is Elohim, the Almighty God, the powerful God, who created out of nothing, just by the word of His mouth. This section comes to a climax with the creation of man. Beginning at chapter 2 and verse 4 and going through verse 25, the focus changes from the creation of the universe to the creation of man. Now it is not Elohim who is at work. It is Jehovah, the covenant-keeping God. And there is a change of name, not because there is a change of God, as the liberal would suggest, but a change of name because there is a change of purpose being conveyed. It's man who is the climax of the first section. It is marriage which is the climax of the second section. It is the covenant-keeping God who calls a man and a woman into a contractual relationship for life. One man, one woman, forever. This is God's pattern. Now I want to plug into the narrative at verse 27, and I want you to follow very closely if you have a Bible before you. God created man in His own image. In the image of God created He him. Now note, male and female created He them. Will you mark it well? The first mention of the creation of man underscores the polarity of the sexes. There is no such thing as a human being apart from maleness and femaleness. That's the most distinctive thing about you. And when Paul said, don't allow the world to squeeze you into its mold, he had a very telling word for our generation. Because men and women, you are living in a generation that is masculinizing women and that is feminizing men with devastating consequences. And I hope that with all of the force within you and with all of the dynamic of the Holy Spirit, you will resist the pressures of your society. And that you will cultivate enthusiastically the most distinctive thing about you, your masculinity, your femininity. And if you ever lose that, you are dead. You are a pervert. You have prostituted the creative genius of God. God blessed them, and He said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion. And then the spheres are given. Now look down in verse 31 for a climactic statement. If you read back through Genesis chapter 1, you will find a repeated statement. God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. After every creative day, the summary, God saw that it was good. And in verse 31, climactically, God saw everything that He had made, and behold, it was very good. But in chapter 2, in verse 18, your attention is jarred with a contrast. And Jehovah God said, it is not good that man should be alone. And every man said, amen. Good night. No wonder Mayhall brought me up here. You know, that's an amazing statement. God said. I didn't say that. God said, it's not good. The aloneness of man disturbed God. Now, I say it's a remarkable statement when you think of the context. In the first place, man had a perfect environment. No ecological problems here. Man had unlimited creative potential. All of the fulfillment he could ever handle. Man had unbroken fellowship and communion with the Father. And with all of that, God said, there's something lacking. Now, this is very interesting. In fact, it's the greatest blow to homosexuality in the Scriptures. For if another man could ever meet the aloneness of this man, then there was no need for the creation of woman. But another man will never be able to meet the aloneness which disturbed God. Only a woman would meet that aloneness. So God said, I will make him a helper, fit for him. Not to give fits. The Hebrew word means one answering back to, and don't take that too literally. This is the picture. It's the picture of this created being. And the mating call goes out, but there's no one to respond. So God says, I'm going to make him a helper. Tailor-made to his specifications. Who will fill up the empty spaces in his life. And gentlemen, don't ever get married. Ever. Until you come to the realization that you need that woman. Not that she's nice to have, but that you are totally incomplete without her. You'll never make it alone. Then and only then do you have a basis for a biblical marriage. Now, it's interesting because when God introduces this man to this helper, he immediately identifies this as the answer. Or in verse 23, we read, and this man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. What a tame translation. You know what he said? Don't look at me that way. It's a direct translation from the Hebrew. It's the most exclamatory form in Hebrew. Literally translated, here, now, at last. Where in the world have you been all my life? See, he immediately recognized her as the answer to his need, to his aloneness. Bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, and I might add, boredom of my boredom. Everything you are as a person, my lady friend, you bring to the partnership. And if you are an emotional cripple, then you bring that to the partnership, as does your husband. See, my friends, marriage is not finding the right person. It's being the right person. For the partnership is only as strong as the persons who constitute the partnership. Now, I would like to take this truth, and I would like to summarize for you in just four principles. This is probably all of the time we will have for the subject. In terms of what the Word of God teaches in this area, it teaches much more, I assure you. Principle number one. Marriage and the family are of divine origin. Marriage and the family are of divine origin. It takes three to make a Christian marriage. It takes the Lord. It takes a man. It takes a woman. And the dynamic of this horizontal relationship is always determined by the dynamic of this vertical relationship. The more dynamic your relationship with the Lord as a man, the more dynamic your relationship with a wife to whom you are married. The more dynamic your relationship as a woman to the Lord, the more dynamic your relationship to your husband. And the genius of marriage from a Christian point of view is not physical. It's spiritual. And the physical becomes the product of the spiritual relationship. You will never develop your intimate sex life by concentrating on the physical relationship. This is what everybody's out to lunch on right now. So the market is literally gutted with garbage. And everybody's running around trying to get a hold of a book that'll help to prop up the sagging sex life they've got. And I say, my friend, if you got a sagging sex life, I got news for you. Those books will never solve your problems. You're going to have to work at a much more significant level. May I suggest one thing to you, my friends? If you are ever out of fellowship with the Lord, it will be very short before you will be out of fellowship with your partner. In fact, I am so convinced of this that I discover if I am ever out of fellowship with my wife, I automatically conclude I'm out of fellowship with Jesus Christ. So don't try to get right with her or with him. You better start by renewing your relationship to the living Lord. Now, the important thing to see in this proposition that marriage and the family are of divine origin in terms of sex is that family is the ideal, divinely structured context for sex education. And are we ever into a hassle on this one? You know, the big question is, where should we educate our children concerning sex? And, of course, everybody's all uptight over the school taking over this. The truth of the matter is, the average couple, the average man and woman, are very poorly prepared and very poorly related to provide that kind of education. Let me give you an illustration. Let's suppose that God brings into your marriage a boy and a girl. If you have an ideal home, then you have two boys and two girls. Pardon my prejudice. Now, we have known for years that this boy must sustain a positive, wholesome relationship with his father, because it's from his father that he gets the idea of what it means to be a man, masculine. And if his father's a very weak, sort of out-to-lunch type of individual, then that's what he produces after his kind. We've known that it's very important for this girl to sustain a very close, intimate, personal relationship with her mother, because it's from her mother that she gets the idea of what it means to be a woman, what it means to be female. And if her mother is always saying, well, men are like that, then she's rearing a first-class pervert. If every time the monthly cycle rolls around, everybody hits the fan and we all come unglued as we're now into the curse, she'll probably rear a girl who's about as neurotic as she is. Probably a little more. You usually intensify the neuroticism. But this is the roughie. And I want you to listen very closely, because this is the greatest perversion on the American scene today. That's homosexuality. We are now up to 7 out of every 100. In Southern California, 22 out of 100. And the question is often raised, how do you develop a homosexual child? It's very simple. The finest people in all of the world produce homosexuals. They come out of a lot of Christian homes. This is how you develop one. It's not only important for this boy to relate to this man, but it's also important for this boy to relate, but not to over-relate to that woman. So I hope, ladies, if you have a son, that you are doing everything possible to affirm his masculinity, to push him out the front door. And every time he does anything of which you are proud in terms of his masculinity, you affirm it. You tell him, man, Mom's proud of you, buddy. You go out to the football game, and instead of getting all uptight over whether he's going to get a broken arm or something else, you yell your head off. That'll work your tension out. And you make sure you send them off to camp. I know you're going to set up the 7 sets of underwear all in the suitcase. He's going to come back at the end of next week with all 7 sets. You're going to have to peel the original ones off. Ladies say, oh my, I don't know how I'll make it sending my boy to camp. So you mean how you'll make it or he'll make it? So he'll do well. Our problem will be with you. The hardest thing to get women to do is to let go of that grip. That's called emotional incest. It's lethal. It's also important for this girl not only to relate to her mother, but to relate to her father, but not to over-relate. And I have a girl in counseling right now. Was married to one of our men. Lovely person. What a couple. Fantastic. This girl's so much in love with her husband, she can taste it. She knows the Word of God from the front end to the back end. I think she's memorized every passage on sex. But every time she gets close to her husband, she just breaks out in the most violent rash. because she overrelated to a father in the ministry. My little girl. Now I'll show you how you overrelate. This man will overrelate to that girl when he stops loving that woman. This woman will overrelate to that boy when she stops loving that man and responding to his love. That's why the most secure child in all of the world is a child who is reared in a home where he always knows he's number two, never number one. Your mother is number one. Your father is number two. And it really makes very little difference, friends, what you say as a man to your children about sex. Very little difference. But it makes all of the difference in the world how you as a man relate to that woman. And if you love that woman, and if you magnify that woman, and if you are tender to that woman, and if you model before that boy what it means to love your wife as Christ loved the church, you will never produce a pervert. There is no way. My boy came flying through the front door some time ago. My wife and I were embracing in the living room. He was bringing his buddy. He said, "Good night. We're going to have to wait a minute." He says, "Why? What's the matter?" "Oh," I said, "my parents are in here smooching again." Well, the kid said, "Let's go in." "Oh," he said, "this goes on all the time around our house." The little kid looks him straight in the eye and says, "Boy, Bill, it must be fantastic to have a father that loves your mother." He said, "I don't even know who my father is. Every night we got a different jerk in this house. Must be wonderful to have a father that loves your mother." And my friend, to a kid who takes that for granted, he gets a liberal arts education crammed right down the center of his throat. Greatest thing you can do for your child, gentlemen, in terms of their sex education, is to love your child's mother. And don't be ashamed to express it. Now, don't evaluate this on the basis of your kids, especially if they're teenagers. You know, because every time you embrace, "Oh no, here we go again. Tongue sickening." Man, that's the most secure thing in a person's life. Now may I add one more dimension, because that's a part of the family and the sex education too, and that is the relationship these kids have. Your kids fight? They don't do that. That's right, they're navigator kids. I'm sorry about that. Well, my kids weren't navigator kids. They fought. We used to have knockdown dragouts. We fought the Civil War over so many times. We got a monument down there for it. Boy, and they'd be two against two this morning. Of course, this afternoon, they've switched sides. But I dare any one of you to lay a hand on one of my girls in the presence of my sons. You know, and it still grabs the living daylights out of me to see my gal Bev, 21, get off the plane, and Bob, her older brother at 23, with a tear streaming down his face, give her the biggest bear hug with his peers standing around saying, "That's your sister?" See, don't let it shake you up that the kids have a little hassles. That's tremendous preparation for marriage. That's the polishing machine. And that's one reason why kids who come from multi-sexed families and multi-child families are the most finely prepared people in all of the world. I took a study in our current student body and discovered the most well-adjusted kids in our student body in their marriage. Our kids who come from families with 7, 8, 9, and 12 children. I mean, what else do you do but adjust? It's a survival factor. But you see, these are the people who have an awful lot of the hang-ups worked out for them. This lady comes to me and says, "Oh, Professor Henry, I got a pervert." I said, "You got a pervert? Tell me about it." "Well, my boy." I said, "Well, how is he a pervert?" "Well, he rushed into the bathroom where my girl was undressing and saw her there." He said, "How old is he?" "3. I said, "Lady, I got wonderful news for you. He's not a pervert. He's disgustingly normal." Now, what I'm saying is this. Marriage and the family are of divine origin. And the dynamic of that unit, the most impactful unit in any society, is the dynamic of the Lord in the life of these two people. Not only in their relationship to each other, but also to the children. He is the secret of the functioning of a family and of a marriage. And that's why the psalmist says, Psalm 127:1, "Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it." And he says, don't try to get up earlier and don't try to stay up later to pull it off, because you'll never make it. You'll only live to eat the bread of sorrows. And I've told a number of you, I can almost see the dynamic change in my family the moment my wife and I came to terms with this truth. For years, we tried to pull it off and almost blew ourselves clean out of the saddle. And finally threw in the towel and said, "Lord, unless you do it, we'll never make it." And he loves to hear that, because then when he works, you will never be able to say, "I was a competent parent," or "I was a competent partner." All you will be able to say is, "To God be the glory. Great things he hath done." That's what he honors. The second principle I want to share with you, and we need 2 hours for this one, so fasten your safety belts, let's move. Sex is a gift of God with purpose. Will you mark it well? It was given as a gift of God to man before man sinned. So it is not the original sin. And it is not sin. Let's look in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16. This is a very significant verse, because this is a verse that follows the fall. "Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy pain and thy conception." Now note, "In pain shalt thou bring forth children." Yet, the Hebrew demands that we translate it. "Yet, thy desire," and that's the word for sexual passion, "thy sexual passion shall continue to be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." You see, sin affected the product of intercourse, but not the process. And despite the fact that a woman will have pain in conception, in birth, yet this will not in any way abate her sexual drive toward her husband. This is completely intact. Now, what is the purpose of sex? Well, it's threefold. And let's see if we can summarize it for you briefly, give you some passages that you can use in teaching this. The first purpose is to provide for parenthood. It's the purpose of propagation. to provide for parenthood, propagation. And jot down these passages. Genesis 1, 27 and 28. The promise which is repeated in chapter 9 and verse 1. And Psalm 127. And I want you to turn there. My friend, children are the God-ordained outcome of marriage and of sexual relations. That's why sex without marriage is forbidden by God. That's the privilege without the responsibility. And God says, when you take on the privilege, you also take on the responsibility. For if out of that sexual relationship a child is born, and you do not have a contractual relationship in a marriage, then what guarantee and security does the child have? Now, in the 127th Psalm, beginning of verse 3, there are three descriptive terms of children. Remember, childlessness is a curse in the Old Testament, in contrast to our society, when having a child is a curse. So he gives three statements. First of all, children are a heritage. Underline that word. It means property. It means possession. Brown, Driver, and Briggs, the leading lexicographers, say it must be translated assignment. Isn't that beautiful? Children are your assignment. So you think God gives you children because of what you can do for them. I got news for you. God gives you children because of what they can do for you. You wouldn't be worth a dime without your kids. So stop griping. Stop saying, Lord, why did you give me him? Because you needed it. And I want you to know, my friends, that the greatest contribution anyone has ever made to my life has been made by my four children. I know of no one on earth, apart from my wife, who has ministered to me personally, spiritually, as my children have. I rise up to call them blessed. They are the greatest satisfaction of my life. And I just want you to know, if the plane goes down on my way back, that you have listened to a completely fulfilled man on the basis of my four children. I have no greater joy. My ministry is peanuts compared with the ministry those four kids will have. Secondly, the fruit of the womb is his reward. Underline that. Not curse, not tragedy, not accident. Reward. They are a sign of the favor of God upon you. So when you go home, will you get down on your knees and thank God for each one? Never forget the night I was studying in this thing, and man, I got so carried away, I just came right up off the chair, clean out of my study, braced my wife, picked her right up off her feet, shared with her what God had taught me from the passage, and we went in to stand by those beds, each one, one by one, and knelt down together as a couple to thank God for Barb. What a pleasurable reward. And to move on to Bob, and to Beth, and to Bill, and to say, what a sign of the favor of God. And for the two that we lost, favor, reward. And fourth, as arrows. There it is. See, an arrow is something launched in the air toward a target. Well, that presupposes you know where you're going. You have some goals. It's Aristotle who said, like archers, we shall stand a far greater chance of hitting the target if we can see it. That's profound. Now, let me hit you with one more thing in this area about your culture. And that is, your generation is selling you a bill of goods, and some of you have swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. And it says, two and no more. Now, my friend, I don't know what God is telling you. Maybe He will say to some of you, none. Because God is a creative God. He has many ways of favoring His children. And so if you have children, it's obviously a sign He has favored you. If you don't have children, this is no sign He has not favored you. That's a non sequitur argument. But all I'm saying is this. If God tells you two and no more, man, you've got the will of God. But I don't want your pagan society telling you, a born-again, regenerate Christian, what the standard is for your home. And you better not take your attention, because someday you may wake up to the realization that somebody sold you down the river. Only now, that's no longer an option. This passage tells me in Genesis 1:27 and 28 that children are the normal but not the exclusive purpose of sex. So that leads to a second purpose, and that's to prevent fornication. That's the preventive purpose of sex. So let's turn over to the New Testament, to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Chapter 7. Now, concerning the things whereof you wrote, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of fornications, that is, and that's a plural, because of a fornicatious society, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. In other words, in order to prevent fornication, there are parameters for marriage in which this God-given drive has a legitimate outlet. See, God gives drives, He also gives designs in which those drives function constructively. And sex without marriage is absolutely devastating. I think of all of the counseling I do, there is nothing as devastating as a kid sitting across from there who's just blown the whole thing to shred and suddenly comes to the realization there was another way. Well, I have kids, you know, who are at the seminary, committed to Jesus Christ, married, in the love of the woman. You wouldn't believe the problems these kids have. Man, they got problems on their problems. Because, my friend, you cannot flaunt the standards of God without paying a price. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. My friend, that was spoken to Christians. You are free to make the choice, but you are not free to escape the consequences of your choice. And there's many a couple today, ones with whom you are going to be counseling. I'll clue you, man, you're going to have your heart torn right out of the middle of your chest if you got a heart that beats for people. I'll tell you, sometimes you're going to cry to God with anguish such as you've never known, talking to this lovely couple sitting across from you trying to put the thing together, having shot themselves out of the saddle before they ever came to the ball game. And what a heartbreak. Now he goes on, as you know, let the husband render unto the wife her due. That's a lovely word, isn't it? I often used to think, isn't that nice, her due? She's a dues-paying member. No, her conjugal rights. Her rights, not yours. And likewise also the wife unto the husband. Now that's a remarkable statement. Mind you, that's hundreds of years before Masters and Johnson, who came along with this profound discovery that a woman should enjoy sex. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I'll show you that Moses taught that. The Apostle Paul taught that. See, sex is not something for a woman to endure. It's something for her to enjoy. And gentlemen, your primary purpose in life in a marriage role is to see to it that that woman is fulfilled. And friend, that's a full-time assignment. That'll take out every ounce of creativity you got. This guy's always saying, well, I'm not getting much out of it. I got news for you. You're not supposed to. I said, send your wife in. I'll talk to her. We'll go the other route. But as far as you, your primary purpose is to give to her. Now, if you get two people coming into a marriage in which my primary role is to satisfy my wife and my wife's primary role is to satisfy me, friend, we're in business. We can't lose. But if I come into it asking, what am I getting out of it? And she comes into it saying, what does she get out of it? We both lose. And that's exactly where we are today. Oh, what a price. The woman does not have power over her own body, but the husband likewise. The husband has not power over his own body, but the wife. And then stop defrauding ye one the other. Man, I have a beautiful time with this one. Cut it out. If you're doing it, cut it out. If you're not doing it, don't ever get the habit. And then he gives the specifications for abstinence. Did you ever ask yourself that question? When's the last time you and your wife did not have sex because of your deeper spiritual involvement? See, there may be times when you haven't had sex for all kinds of other reasons. When's the last time both of you were so sold out in spiritual involvement that the physical did not take precedence over the spiritual? See, until you come to that place, you'll never know any degree of intimacy in your marriage, physically. But he says, come together again, and you can see the reason. All right, the third one. Yeah, man.
Could you elaborate on that?
On which one?
That last point.
What was the last point?
The absence of...
Oh, yeah. You see, he says that you may give yourselves unto prayer. And what I'm asking you is, when's the last time, you know, you gave yourself to prayer? Let's say concerning a decision, you know, a friend going to Germany. Where are my involvement? By the way, this is a blast, you see, at all the charismatic movements, who always teach that the physical is more important than the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches the physical is important, but it's only important when it's seen in light of the spiritual. That's why it's not that important that you be healed. It's not always that important that you get rid of the thorn in the flesh. There's a greater purpose God is working. That's spiritual. And when you see that, then the physical takes on meaning. Help?
Yeah, I guess the question I'm asking is that in the same category as fasting?
I think so. Right. Though that's not mentioned here. It's a spiritual fasting. All right, third reason. Oh, yeah. Hey, this sad banana clock. You ever get on this subject that goes faster? Got to talk to the Lord about this. Third is to promote mutual love. That's the pleasure principle. And don't back off from that, will you? You know one of the greatest hang-ups that all of us face? It's the hang-up of Platonic dualism. That's a long time back to Plato, but it's very deeply with us in evangelicalism. And that is, Platonic philosophy basically taught that the body is bad. And therefore, it's either to be indulged or it is to be denied. So on the one hand, you had promiscuity. On the other hand, you had asceticism. It's the soul that is the important thing in life. Now, the Bible doesn't teach that. It teaches the priority of the spiritual by which the material takes on meaning, but there is as much hope for your body as there is for your soul. And don't deny it. But what happens is we get two kinds of philosophy. For instance, we get a Playboy philosophy on this side, and we get a puritanical philosophy on this side. I love to get into a debate with these guys, because you can always hang them, because you know exactly what tack they're going to take. They're going to take Puritanism, and they're going to try to hang that on you as the biblical view of sex. And I just love to get them into it, because I draw them out. And that's why, oh yeah, well, I didn't know you know that much about us. And keep drawing. Woo! We get them all the way out. We get way out on the end of the limb and then saw like crazy. I was in a debate with a guy not too long ago, and a guy, whoa, way out here. I said, is that what the Christianity teaches? That's it. He gave me quote to all kind of garbage. We finally got through to the end. I said, friend, I got news for you. I totally repudiate everything you said about the Christian view of sex. So he repeated the argument. We had us a ball. Because you see, that's what Hefner did. Hey, for your information, did you know he was the product of an evangelical church? Do you know there are 17 key men on his staff who are out of evangelical backgrounds? One of them, a mother, talked to me recently. What a heartbreak. Hefner comes up with the slickest type of pornography. My wife tells me that the key articles in Playboy magazine pays $35,000 for one article to a writer. Put out the slick type of thing, you see, and then he drags in Puritanism, and he brings out that sad chestnut of the dear Puritan, you know, some back... We're back there who probably was conditioned as unbiblically as a lot of people are, and who said that he thought he saw his wife smiling during intercourse, so they took her out in the public square and made a spectacle of her, and he says, that's what Christianity teaches. And I say, really? Baloney. Christianity never taught that. You can't find a shred of evidence in the Scriptures to support it. You ever debate? That's a very clever trick. What you do in debating, particularly if you're losing your argument, is to take the position of your opponent, caricature it, and then crucify it. See, so that's what he does. See, that's Christianity, I say, man. That's not Christianity. The Puritans were as out to lunch as a lot of other people in this area. They were people with limitations. All right, let's look at a couple passages of Scripture, man. I told you we ain't going to get far. Let's look at Genesis 18:12. Huh, this is lovely. Genesis 18:12. Let's start at verse 9. You remember the three angels visit Abraham on the plains of Mamre. So they said unto him, where is Sarah your wife? Well, he said, she's in a tent. So he said, I'll certainly return unto you when the season cometh round. And lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son. And Sarah roared in the tent door. She's listening through the keyhole. And Abraham and Sarah were old and well stricken in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. That's the biblical statement. She had it. Hopeless. Biological impossibility. That's why she roared. Notice. And Sarah roared within herself, saying, after I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure? That's the word for sexual gratification. She said, don't be ridiculous. I'm beyond the point of sexual arousal. There's no way. And we've got double trouble. Because, she says, my Lord being old also. And that's a rather rough combination. And Jehovah said unto Abraham, wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I be a surety bear a child who am old? Is anything too hard for God? That's where he specializes. See, resurrection power works best in the cemetery. That's what he said in Hebrews. It's where he got it. Out of the deadness of Sarah and the death of Abraham, God brings forth life. When he tells her she's going to have a child, she says, good night, I can't even conceive a child. I can't even get sexually aroused. Don't be ridiculous. Now, turn over to Genesis 18. 26 in verse 8. Yep. Well, let's begin reading in verse 6. And Isaac dwelt in Gerar, and the men of the place asked him of his wife. And he said, she's my sister. You know, real courageous. Because he feared to say my wife, lest, said he, the man of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon. By the way, where did he pick up that idea? Yeah, see? An illustration of the paternal pattern. See, Pop never sat down and said, son, if you ever get in this kind of a rhubarb, pull this one up. He just did it. And when a kid gets into it, that's exactly what he does. Now look. And it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of the window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting. That's a lovely translation. Favorite indoor sport. The word is fondling, playing, Isaacing. It's a play on his word, his name. He was playing with Rebekah's wife sexually, and Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, of a surety she's your wife. Man, I got proof positive she's your wife, because you don't do that to your sister. Deuteronomy 24:5. Man, here's a promise the Navs ought to keep. Boy, I wish I could get this one into the seminary. Deuteronomy 24 and verse 5. When a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out in the hosts, that is, in the battle, in the army, neither shall he be charged with any business. You know, we're not that enlightened today. A man gets married, exempt from military service, exempt for business for a year. What's he going to do during that year? Well, he shall be free at home 1 year and shall cheer. That's a lovely one, too. Because that one means he shall sexually pleasureize his wife. 1 year of sexual adjustment. I would say 90% of the sexual problems in our generation are the product of people who got all hung up in the first year of their marriage. So I spend all of my time trying to unravel this stuff. Boy, what great wisdom God had. You see, my friends, you cannot adjust to two relationships at one time. I hope you don't take on a responsibility immediately following marrying a wife. I hope you're perceptive enough, spiritually, biblically, and practically, to realize that when you take on a wife, you take on a responsibility, and you ought to carve out a delicious slice of time so that you can spend all of your energies building that kind of a relationship, making those adjustments. Then when you move in to what God calls you, it's going to be vastly different. Well, I don't have time to look at these others. Look at Proverbs 5, 18 and 19. That's a delightful passage. Just studying this the other night in the Hebrew text, it's absolutely out of sight. He's to be ravished with his wife's breasts, the wife of his youth. And what a contrast. You will notice it's in a context of illegitimate sex. It's the stark contrast. Don't live like the heathen if you're a Christian. What do the heathen do? Shack up. What do you do? What do the heathen do? Look at Playboy magazine. What do you do? What do the heathen do? Read all of the perverted literature. What do you do? What do the heathen do? Live for themselves. What can I get out of this object? And when I'm through with her like a toy that's wasted, I drop her. No wonder women's lib is climbing the walls over Playboy. I think they're smarter than Playboy. And the Christian should have been in the forefront of the battle. Because the Word of God never teaches a woman as an object, but as a person with the highest respect. And then the Song of Solomon. My colleague and I are trying to get back on a translation we started some time ago. By the way, when we get through with this translation, you will know what Song of Solomon's talking about. You know, the average person, they read that thing and they say, well, that's very interesting poetry. But you know, they don't have a clue that this is a poem of married love. Here are two people in the presence of each other, totally nude and totally ravished by the experience. And he starts at the top of her head and he goes to the bottom of her feet. She starts at the bottom of his feet, goes to the top of his head, and there's absolutely no embarrassment. There is nothing but pure pleasure. My friend, if you interpreted every other passage of the Scriptures like most people interpret Song of Solomon, you would be in liberalism. Because they allegorize it. And I happen to believe that one of the great needs of our generation is to put this book in a form in which people understand exactly what God is talking about. And He doesn't stutter. It's a beautiful picture. If you're having problems in this area, I would encourage you to read it as a couple. All right, let me give you two others just briefly. And I mean briefly. First of all, we said marriage and family are of divine origin. Secondly, we said sex is a gift of God with purpose, and we've given three purposes. Now, third, marriage, one relationship must be broken before another relationship can be established. One relationship must be broken before another relationship can be established. In Genesis 2 and verse 24, there are two very strong verbs. Underline them in your Bible. The first is the verb leave, and the other is the verb cleave. The word leave means to abandon, to forsake. So you mean to tell me God is telling you to abandon, to forsake your parents? Yes, in a particular area. You are never to forsake your parents in terms of your responsibility to them. New Testament says if a man does not care for his parents, he's worse than an infidel. That's pretty strong language. You are to leave your parents not in terms of responsibility, but in terms of relationship. And the last thing to be broken is the emotional umbilical cord. And if you're working at the student level, you know what I'm talking about. I have a friend of mine on the university campus who's a dean. He said, Hendricks, our students arrive with their umbilical cords in their hands looking for a place to plug it in. Which is a little graphic. You wouldn't believe what we get. I got a guy from New York some time ago who had never been away from home. Up until age 24, God calls him to seminary, of all places in Dallas. Mom took him to school every day and picked him up. Isn't that lovely? So she buys him an American Airlines ticket and puts him on an American Airlines plane and fastens his American Airlines seatbelt and sends him to us. Man, when he arrived, he's the sickest puppy you have ever seen. Oh, he said, I'm homesick. Well, I say, I appreciate that, my friend. Seems to me you got a wonderful laboratory in to work this out because you're going to be here for 4 years. So he went from one man to another. Finally, I was going out for a weekend of ministry. I said to my colleague, look, you better keep your eye on him. So help me, he's going home. Monday morning, he picked me up in the airport. He went home. His mother wired him the money so he could get an airplane ticket to come home and be with her. Doesn't that really grab you? You want to borrow it? You got the sequel to the story some time ago. This guy's now in the army. And he can't go home. And it'll probably either make him or break him. You know, you can laugh at that because you can see it in an extreme. Anytime you do anything for your child, which your child is capable of doing for himself, you are making him an emotional cripple. You're making him a handicapped person for his marriage. Oh, parents come to me and said, oh, what's the matter? Oh, my boy's going away to college. I said, what are you crying about? I said, what have you been doing for the last 18 years? Preparing him for college. What are you crying about? You ought to be shouting glory through the bunghole. We just got rid of the last one this fall. This is fantastic. We're living it up. So you have 18 years in which to get rid of your kids. Are you in a process of doing that? Are you making it easier or harder for your kids to leave you? Some people get a vice grip on that kid. And in marriage, you know, what a problem. And cleave, that means weld, glued. That's a separation-proof relationship. And if a couple comes into marriage with the conviction there is no way out, they're going to solve their problems. If you come into marriage thinking, if it doesn't work, we can always get out, then the possibilities are fantastic. You can believe the reasons people get divorces. Things that you and I solve every day in our marriage. But you see, after you live with that type of thing, you know, for 5, 10 years, that's just a symbol. It becomes a great, big, enormous mountain. He won't pick up his pajamas. That's what a lady told me. Fourth. You always let the counselee make the statements, by the way. After I had her draw up that list, I said, well, give me your list. She said, well, he won't pick up his pajamas. I said, all right, let's write that down. That's very significant. And as I understand it, you want to get a divorce because he won't pick up his pajamas. Well, she said, that's kind of silly, isn't it? You let them make the statements. Ah, yeah, boy. This one I'm working on with all I got. Man, what an assignment. You know my wife? Oh, you should know my wife. Intimacy in a marriage is a lifelong process of communication. Intimacy in a marriage is a lifelong process of cultivation. That's why he said you shall leave father and mother and shall cleave unto your wife, and they two shall become. That's a process verb. One flesh. You don't become one flesh when you go to bed. My friends, animals copulate. That's not one flesh. One flesh is a process of two people flowing into the lives of the other in every area. Emotionally. Intellectually. Socially, spiritually, as well as sexually. And what an exciting assignment it is. I must confess that of all of the messages that I have given, if there's any one that I hope you will never forget, not because everything that I said to you represents the most profound thing in all of the world, but because I assure you, this will become your greatest distinctive as a navigator in your ministry. You show me a nav couple. I don't care if they are in the United States or India or Africa, Europe, wherever they are. You show me a nav couple who are incurably in love with each other and developing an intimacy of relationship as a couple, and I will show you the most distinctive person in this generation. And every year goes by, you will become more of a phenomenon. See, the missionaries have been telling us that for years. What's the most distinctive feature in a pagan culture? A Christian home. Stands out like a neon sign in the Gobi Desert. So what happens? Well, as your society becomes increasingly more pagan, and it's doing that by the hour, you become more of a phenomenon. It's part of our ministry as a couple. We are cultivating our community in which we have recently moved. What an experience we're having. So during the Christmas holidays when my kids were home, we prayed a lot about it, and we invited everybody in the community to come over. Man, we have about 39, 45 people over there. We never had so many pagans in our home. It was wall to wall. And finally, they're going out the door, and we're greeting them, telling them how fantastic it's been to have them, so forth. And this lady goes out the door and without her husband, so I figure, you know, he must have gone out before. So pretty soon she comes running back. She says, "Where in the world is my husband?" He said, "Well, I don't have a clue. Let's go looking for him." So we started on this archaeological expedition. You know where I found him? I found him in a back room with Bill, my younger son, sharing the gospel with him. And later I said, "Hey, Bill, how did this open up?" He said, "Dad, would you believe the guy came in and asked me to sit down?" So I sat down. And he leaned across my desk and he says, "Son, what makes this outfit tick?" And you got to know my boy Bill to appreciate it. Bill said, "You really want to know?" He says, "Yeah, I do." He said, "How straight do you want it?" All right, I said, "You know, tell it like it is, son." "Okay." Boom. The interesting thing is that guy has been in our home every day since. He's still in the process of putting it together. You know, here they are, those odd wads there. And they're not only living together, this is the first time you've been married. Isn't that interesting? And you're still enjoying it. Do you look at me, because some of you sometimes get such a jaundiced view of the Christian life that you need a good dose of paganism every now and then just to open your eyes to what it means to be in Jesus Christ. And your whole society's going to hell in a hat box. And you ask, what do you got that's distinctive to offer them? Well, I'll clue you. If your marriage comes unglued, you have nothing to offer your pagan society. Nothing. They can produce a better split than you can. But if you got a distinctive relationship in Jesus Christ, an intimacy level that's the product of the Spirit bringing together two people who become one flesh, then I assure you, you have the most distinctive thing to offer your generation. That's what will give you leverage in your ministry. Don't settle for anything less. Dear Father,